Hello! And welcome to...
So good to see you. Sorry.
Yes, Mersa. Introduce yourself.
I am Mersa Baradaran. I am the author of, most recently, The Color of Money, Black Banks and the Racial Wealth Gap. And I'm also a professor of law at the University of Georgia.
And so we are going to have a whole Color of Money edition in honor of Mersa Baradaran. We are going to talk about black banking. We are going to talk about black wealth. We're going to talk about reparations. We're going to talk about opportunity zones. We're going to talk about history. We are going to put this all in context. We are going to go back centuries. We are going to talk about Haiti. We are going to talk... You have no idea how much amazing knowledge is going to get dropped in a relatively short podcast. This is going to be dense, fun, interesting. It's going to be not just Mersa, but it's going to be me. I should introduce myself. I am Felix Salmon of Axios. It is going to be Anna Szymanski.
Hello.
And also Emily Peck of the Huffington Post.
Hello.
And all of this is going to be coming up right here on Slate Money.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/AmicusPlus to get access wherever you listen.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
So let's start with your book,
yes,
which has been out for a while and everyone has read it already. But for those people who haven't read it already, what's it called?
It's called The Color of Money, Black Banks and the Racial Wealth Gap.
And this is an amazing history of black banking in America, and not just black banking, but also just the way that African-Americans found it incredibly hard to hold on to their money, and they tried to create their own banks, which you would think would help them hold on to their money, but it didn't really work out that way.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the way banks work, right, you need, you know, this fractional reserve lending, right? So the money multiplier works if you're able to do fractional reserve lending, but you have to be part of a network of other banks. So that lending creates money, but it doesn't work if you have a segregated black bank who's, you can take deposits from black depositors and you can lend to black borrowers, but there's no way to, you know, quote unquote, control the black dollar, which was the main purpose of these banks. Because as soon as you make a loan, that asset, whether it's a house or a company or whatever, is owned by some white person, usually because of the history of capital and who had it. And so as soon as you make that loan, you're seeing this money leak out of the community. And it would work if they were lending back in.
So basically, you will lend you'll lend money to an African-American borrower to buy a house.
Yes.
But when they buy the house, they're invariably buying it from a white person. So the cash winds up going to a white person and the money leaves the black community.
And also, I think you point out that the banks were essentially set up to fail because their depositors, they tended to be smaller deposits. Mm-hmm. It was a bit more erratic. And then a lot of their loans were a little bit riskier. They couldn't sell the loans. And throughout a lot of history, unfortunately, if you lent to an African-American, then the loan would immediately the value would decline. So these banks were set up to fail, essentially.
Yes. I mean, they didn't know that. And nobody was doing it cynically, but absolutely right. So the deposits are bank liability. So these are little mini loans that you're giving a bank. And banks don't want less than $2,000 or $2,500, whatever their profitability ratio is. I mean, these days, banks are just getting their money from reserves anyway. But in the old days, you actually needed deposits to make loans to some extent. And so if they're getting from wage earners, which, you know, most blacks, because of, you know, segregation and discrimination, were just, you know, low wage earners. So their deposits are very volatile and very risky. And so they have to, one, offset them, you know, on the asset side, but also there are a lot of operating costs to these deposits, right? The asset side, that's where you're making the money, are on loans, right? So there aren't big businesses to lend to. That's more profitable. And the home mortgages that they're paying for are in rapidly devaluing property. So the first black families that move into a neighborhood, and this is unfortunately still the case, not exactly, but kind of, the first black families move into a neighborhood, pay a premium or whatever the market rate is. And then as soon as a neighborhood tips into a black neighborhood, those values plummet. And because of the market, it sort of embeds racism. We don't want to have black neighbors. We don't want to live in a black neighborhood.
So does this mean that, like, black banks are a bad idea and it's good that we basically don't have any anymore?
Yeah, so I'm careful not to make that, because I think one of the things that black banks have done over their history, and this was just a really inspiring sort of look at this history, is that black banks have become, had been the sort of site of protest and community boycott. So MLK, Malcolm X, Jesse Jackson, who is just with today. I mean, they've used these black banks as a method of protest and a community sort of empowerment. And, you know, black banks weren't giving subprime loans during the run-up to the crisis. So you have these black banks that are actually a shield against exploitation. So they have these other services. As a wealth-building mechanism, they're not useful. They're not harmful, but they're not the answer, the sort of silver bullet. And the problem is that white policymakers have kept pushing this segregated banking system as an answer to the racial wealth gap. And
it seems like, I mean, that's the thread running through your book from the very start, from the Freedman's Bank. It's like, well, we're not going to give you any land, but here you can have this bank, and then the guy running the bank will basically steal all your money.
Exactly.
Good luck.
Yeah. And steal is strong. I mean, you know, they call it looting, but like he just speculated it away. So let me go back. I mean, there's two pivotal points in history, Reconstruction and the Civil Rights Movement, where the black community, you know, rightfully says we need justice from these, like, history of, I mean, during Reconstruction is like enslavement for hundreds of years. Like, at least give us the land that we have worked for hundreds of years.
And I'm just going to jump in very quickly, because the one thing which really jumped out of the book, and I haven't been able to stop thinking about since I read it, was this thing about how slaves were not just slaves, but they were collateral. And you got, like, you had sort of collateralized slave obligations, and they would become financialized and securitized. It was the most astonishingly, like, terrifying but also sophisticated financial system set up around a slave-based economy.
Absolutely. I mean, the new history of capitalism sort of literature is really excellent on this. And I've been able to use a lot of that wasn't around before. But in the last 5 or 6 years, there's been a lot of great sort of balance sheet analysis of slavery. How do they collateralize? How do they use slave bodies? Men and women, they're insuring them. They're, you know, by getting other loans based on this collateral, and they're sort of bundling them and securitizing them. And it's not just a Southern thing, right? So these are the planters in the South that own the collateral, but it's New York merchants and Liverpool, you know, traders that are also using these slave bodies as money. And then, of course, the cotton that they're picking, that's the least of it. But yes, the slave bodies were capital themselves. And so you have this transition from, you know, being capital to trying to become capitalists. And so they're saying, all of the abolitionists who are serious abolitionists, and the you know, Frederick Douglass and others, are saying you need land. Without land, freedom and participation in capitalism, that's a farce. And they were right, because what the cotton traders did not want is for the U.S. to go the way of Haiti. And when you have land, when you own land, you're going to grow subsistence crops, because you're going to eat, right? And cotton is a debt crop. Cotton is not, I mean, it's profitable when it is, but it's not a way to feed a family. And so they knew, then in Haiti, they just stopped growing the slave crops and they started growing subsistence crops. And so the North and you know, the merchants in Great Britain were saying, we can't have this. So that's why they couldn't have land. So instead of land, they got the Freedmen's Bank. Same with civil rights. In civil rights, you know, there's different groups saying we want integration. So we want to move in your neighborhood because we've been prohibited. So we want to cut into this FHA mortgage thing, and or we want reparations. And those were serious plans. And Nixon sort of does this thing again that was happening with the Freedmen's Bank, is like have black capitalism, have treasury deposits in black banks, and we'll do contract set asides. Affirmative action was a Nixonian thing. So it's really just using sort of the rhetoric of free market capitalism against these demands. And these demands that were, you know, you have unjustly discriminated against us by state policy. And so what these leaders, Johnson and Nixon, are saying, and others, are saying the market will fix the thing that state policy, backed by violence, by the way, created.
And that's that was so interesting to me, because the other pivot point you really focus on in the book is, of course, the New Deal. And that was, I think at one point you call it, or someone calls it, policy apartheid, because it was like, here was the government and public policy coming in to rescue all these people and help them become homeowners, but not black people.
Exactly.
And they basically get pushed out. So it's like they get the free market capitalism solution and everyone else gets the socialist solution.
So, totally. So
yeah. And we call that the American dream.
So it's like, totally. Instead of land, now, I mean, we have to talk about this because it's now on the agenda. Thank you, Elizabeth Warren.
Yes.
Reparations, the new 40 acres. Is this like, this going to be another thing that people are going to talk about for however many years and nothing's going to happen? Or like, what? Talk a little bit about reparations.
So this is the thing. I mean, I think sometimes we get caught up in terminology like capitalism, socialism. Reparations is another one of these things where everyone thinks of reparations and they're like, their cartoon bubble just doesn't match up, right? And so what I'm saying is 40 acres or a mule, whatever the anti-redlining thing is, wherever you want to sort of peg that claim, the claim is that state policy has extracted labor and goods from the black community and has given whites, I mean, not just the FHA, Homestead Acts and all of these stuff that were racially exclusionary for generations. And so somehow that needs to be remedied. So South Africa has Truth and Reconciliation, you know, the Nuremberg trials. There is a sense of like, you have suffered an injustice and we need to make it right. And all the Civil Rights Acts do, and I don't want to underplay them, but what the 1965 and the Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act does is guarantee to the black population the rights that they were already guaranteed in the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, right? Now we're saying we're serious this time, right? It doesn't do anything to remedy that past injustice. And so call it reparations, call it justice, call it whatever you want. I don't care. We just need to put capital or land or whatever the modern equivalent is of that wealth that was created for whites and not for blacks.
Because the statistic you have in your book, which I think is not as well known as it should be, is that during slavery, before slavery was abolished, blacks in America had about 0.5% of the total wealth. Mm-hmm. And now we have abolished slavery and that 0.5% has gone all the way up to like
1.5%. Exactly.
And isn't a lot of this story around housing? I mean, I think this is what you seem to say in the book. And I think it makes a lot of sense looking at government policy, as you know, Emily, you also mentioned that what the FHA loans did in order to create a white middle class, to create white wealth. And I guess I'm just thinking in terms of policies moving forward. If housing is one of the biggest differences, is that an area to focus on?
Yeah. So housing is the root of the problem. I don't know if it's the solution, but it's a start. And I mean, the rule of capital is those who have it just make more, right? So those who own slaves as capital got to own property later, right? And use that stuff to own whatever it is. So now we're talking about like, you know, the capital that is capital without actually land. So whatever it is, those who had capital are still going to have capital, right? JP Morgan is going to be around for as long as money is around, right? And so maybe the future, the remedy isn't in housing, but that's certainly the cause. I happen to think that housing has to be a part of it, because for most people who don't have, you know, 401ks and stocks and all that stuff, the house is still their primary asset. Now, we have to talk about what kind of loan, where is the house? And there are places in America now where that house isn't worth, it's not holding their equity, it's diminishing. And so we have to put caveats in it. But yes, that is the cause of it. And I want to say, I want to point out something about the New Deal as well. I mean, we talk about the New Deal and the, you know, the progressive era of reforms of the Wilson administration and on. So we leftists, and I'm going to include myself proudly as a leftist, kind of want to redo the New Deal. So we're seeing like the new green, the new New Deal, the Green New Deal, the progressive era, like new progressives. And I want, one of the things that's missed is, okay, we're going to do the New Deal, but we're not going to have the oversights or the blind spots or the gaps that it had last time, which were race. But the New Deal was built on white supremacy. The progressive era reforms that the Wilson administration and the FDR administration pushed were pushed by Southern Democrats. They were pushed by populists, and the early populist movement was an interracial movement, but not the later one. And so the later movements, the Wilson administration is a white supremacist administration. They're able to pass these laws because they're able to convince white workers to use whiteness as opposed to their interracial solidarity.
I mean, that seems to be the big political question right now is if you can do populism without the racism, because Trump won on the populism with the racism.
Yes, we have to. And I think this the thing that I get so frustrated about is like, well, is it about class or is it about race? And every time I talk about the racial wealth gap, someone always asks, well, is it a class thing, this class race thing? And you never hear that when you talk about like gender, the gender wage gap. The people aren't like, well, isn't this a class thing? Well, sure. But like I can walk and chew gum at the same time. Right. Like it can be race and it can be class. It certainly is race and it certainly is class. And those things intersect in weird ways where you have class being used in racist ways. And this is the Trump phenomenon. This is the progressive, the New Deal phenomenon of we will give white workers in the South white supremacy to get them on board for this plan. And so we have to uncouple those in a way. And I don't have the solutions. I just want to point out that it's a problem to put those things against each other.
And the racial wealth gap doesn't care about class. Like if you look at the data, even for professionals, people with degrees, it's still like this massive gap that
huge gap.
Is getting bigger. Is that correct?
Is getting bigger. Yes.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
So let's talk about the thing which is in the news right now, which is the official thing which exists in public policy today, which is trying to bring capital into struggling communities of mostly, you know, black and brown people, which is our favorite new thing called opportunity zones. Mm. Apparently, Long Island City is an opportunity zone. We might talk about that a bit later. But, Marissa, what is an opportunity zone? And, like, is this something that you're seeing people actually get excited about? Or is this just something that Anthony Scaramucci thinks he can make lots of money?
Both. Unfortunately, and this is where my work comes in. And the reason why it's a little bit complicated is I am totally opposed to this idea of policy. And here's why. You have these black segregated spaces that are created by violence and racial covenants and the FHA, right? So you've redlined people into this area and we call it a ghetto because it is not, you know, it's not a black community. They didn't choose to live in, you know, Harlem and South Chicago or Baltimore. That was the only place that they were able to live because the other places weren't open to them. So we have these things called ghettos. And all of a sudden, and this is where Nixon comes in, right? Nixon is able to use, and so there's two ways of responding to the ghetto. One, as James Baldwin says, is the only way to deal with the ghetto is the only way to improve the ghetto is to improve it out of existence, right? So integration. So this is the George Romney, MLK. So there's one way to get rid of the ghetto.
So James Baldwin is a gentrifier, basically.
Well, kind of. I mean, he's just such a creative thinker. I think he could come up with arguments for both. So there's that way. And then the other, not a gentrifier. I want to say an integrationist. And that's an old word and it's got some baggage now. But basically, like, let people live where they want, but push them out. So this is a George Romney, like, we're going to create public housing in white suburbs. And he gets, like, you know, a white riot after he suggests it. So there's integration and then there's reparations. So this is what the black nationalists were saying. Okay, if we're going to have a black ghetto, we want sovereignty. So we see this as a colony. And what colonies do against the colonist is say, we want not just, you know, black businesses, but we want control of our school boards, of our hospitals, of our police, all of that stuff. So these were the two options. And so what Nixon says is, okay, well, I'll take your black power movement and I'll give you black capitalism. And so he starts calling the ghetto. He doesn't do it because he's not quite sophisticated enough, but he calls it like opportunities and capital. And then you get Reagan calling it empowerment zones. And then you get Clinton calling it, like, you know, niche capitalism. So Larry Summers says, you know, black businesses are like market capitalists coming in and finding profits and entrepreneurs where nobody else. So it's like this neoliberal, like, we're not going to give you capital. We're going to send you entrepreneurs and disrupt the ghetto, right? And so now you've got this. So this opportunity zones is not new. It is so Nixonian. It is so Clintonian and Reagan and all of this stuff. It is basically the market's response to the ghetto.
But it's more, well, it's not just the markets. It's also legislators, right? So
yes.
Just to be clear, what we're talking about here,
yes,
is that if you have a bunch of investments in Amazon or some high-flying stock and you bought it very low, and if you sell it, you have to pay lots of capital gains tax, and as a good capitalist, you don't want to pay capital gains tax,
right,
then the government will come along and say, hey,
yeah,
we have a way to mean which will stop you from having to pay the capital gains tax. Just take all of the money you get from selling your Amazon stock and put it into one of these opportunity zones, and then your sale is tax-free and you can keep all of your money. And
yes,
now
well,
what you are doing, or, you know, yeah, with asterisks, and you can then invest it in these zones, which no one entirely knows what that means, but the idea, I guess, is that it's affordable housing and generally trying to make these parts of America, which are, you know, poorer than their neighbors, like, richer again.
And this is part of the Trump tax bill.
Well,
and,
just to be clear, this is actually based on an act that was put forward before the actual tax bill. It was supported by Cory Booker. It was supported. It's a very bipartisan bill, just to be clear. And then it was attached to the tax cuts. And I will say, if you look at a lot of the literature that's coming out around this, they're very well aware of all of the failings of previous attempts to do this kind of thing. They explicitly say, like, there's been a lot of mixed results and a lot of not great results. But what they have seen were there were certain types of programs and certain credits that actually seemed to work somewhat to increase employment. So their idea was, well, let's see what actually worked. Let's try to create a program that replicates that, but on a bigger scale and not simply focused on real estate, which was one of the problems in the past. So I agree that I think historically a lot of the kind of opportunity zone, all of that, has not been overly successful. There have been some successes, and I think it's reasonable to say, well, this is a way to encourage more investment in these areas, because if you look at some of the previous tax credits, it was something like you have the Urban Institute saying, you know, 2/3 of this investment would not have happened without these credits.
So
but
the,
do
so
you
the first
need
question,
investments?
Right,
I mean, this is the
question.
Thing, like, so
why
what
is
do these areas need?
Exactly. Yeah. Is there real evidence, and this is what I'm really asking you, Mercer, it's like, you've been talking to a bunch of, you know, policy wonks about this, and some of them are very enthusiastic about it and some of them aren't. But do you think that if you have an area which is largely black and brown people, that, like, dropping a bunch of money from helicopters onto that area is going to actually help?
Well, it's not money for them. So this is the thing. So you get the investor. So it's like, you know, I used the analogy before, like, it's like having cancer and someone giving you a free car. Like, that's awesome. You are a net beneficiary. If you get that car, that's really great, and you're going to use it and it's going to help you out in your life. So yes, if we're measuring opportunity zones as increased employment and investments and money, great. If we're measuring, what I'm trying to measure is community wealth building, this is not the answer to this, right? So you can call it what it is, and there is some utility here to get more investors and more employment, but it is not wealth creating because those people in that community are not the investors. The investors are always going to be the people with capital. The tenants,
who are like people like Anthony Scaramucci, they're white people
or the
from
tech
outside.
Guys. I mean, this was a bipartisan thing, but it was also pushed by a lot of the tech people who wanted to diversify their asset portfolio. So this has been a long time coming, and there has been other plans by Cory Booker and Representative Cleaver and others who have been pushing opportunity zones, but it finally got passed because of this sort of consortium of tech people. And so they're looking at opportunity zones like you know, the Mission District of San Francisco. Salt Lake is an opportunity zone, as you pointed out in this article. And a couple other, Atlanta, the opportunity zones are not, but even if they were, right? So even if you're talking about a totally distressed area, what this says is if you're a big company and you want to invest in this area, you get a tax credit, okay? So what does investment look like? Let's say like the best case scenario is you totally disrupt, you change this area from distressed to a new hub of, let's say, Delta, okay? What happens to the people on the ground? They were tenants to begin with. They weren't homeowners. So they're not getting the upswing in property values. Maybe you get other small business. Maybe they're getting employed. But in 10 years, they're not living there anymore. If you have revitalized the area with outside investments, that area looks like Harlem does now. The people who were tenants can no longer afford it. They're being pushed out, right? So unless you're giving people a stake in the land and allowing them to have the equity of the upswing, I don't see how this helps fix the racial wealth gap.
Like the opportunity is for the investors, not for the actual people who need help.
Yes.
Well, but I also think just that when this was being put forward, it was not being put forward necessarily as the idea is this is going to solve the racial wealth gap. It was the idea that like we do have a lot of localized poverty, and this is one way to get people to put money in for a long-term investment. And it wasn't And now, look, you have a lot of people who supported this that do support other things like potentially baby bonds and these other ideas. I think the idea that putting money into a community will necessarily mean that the people who are currently living there will only be worse off.
You get the car. But also,
they won't necessarily leave.
So this is where we need to segue into Amazon.
Dun, dun, dun. Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
We were very careful to not talk about Amazon last week because we knew that you were coming on this show. And so now we get to talk about the fiasco that was Amazon's HQ2 in New York City, and only in New York. It doesn't seem to have become a fiasco in Nashville or in Crystal City. But in New York, it was a big focus of protests, and local politicians started coming out against it. And eventually Amazon threw its toys out of the pram and decided they were picking up their toys and going home, and they left. And one or two tears were shed by like Lloyd Blankfein. And then and what was fascinating to me about this entire story was that it was all based around this opportunity zone of Long Island City, which how it got, you know, there's obviously a huge amount of sort of political maneuvering in terms of trying to get these places deemed to be opportunity zones. Even if Amazon had done no negotiating whatsoever with New York State or New York City, they could have just come in to Long Island City and built their headquarters as of right, got most of the tax breaks, not all of them, but most of the tax breaks they were going to get, they could have got as of right. They could have built it, and then everyone would kind of look across the East River from Manhattan one day, and they'd notice Amazon there, and they go, oh, I guess there's another big corporation come to New York, only this time it's in Queens. And that's not what happened, but I feel like if you're protesting Amazon coming into Queens, like, you're really protesting the existence of all of these incentives which exist whether or not you have the negotiations.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it does seem that Amazon really cocked this up, right?
Oh, totally.
I mean, from the start, making it into a beauty contest for all these municipalities across the country. Why draw attention to, like, the biggest company in the world going after, like, tax breaks all, you know, from poor areas. It's then, just like, not a good look.
And then requesting and then, a helicopter landing
pad. Yeah, and requesting like, the helipad, yes. And then coming into New York City and thinking it was going to be easy, which is ridiculous. And then acting kind of like, I mean, maybe it was a good thing that they walked away. I kind of think in the end, probably it's smart that they walked away, but not thinking that they were going to have to negotiate with activists and protesters here was also really dumb. Like, I want to know who came up with the strategy.
New York is a big, messy city, and if you come into New York and expect 100%, you know, to be greeted as liberators or whatever. Yeah. Like,
and it's a free rider problem too, right? Like, Amazon wants to come to New York because New York has great public infrastructure that has been paid for by the taxpayers for a long time, right? I mean, Robert Moses kind of screwed that up a bit, but Long Island has, you know, the public infrastructure has educated their workers. We have built roads and subways and buses where a lot of the country hasn't had that investment in public infrastructure. And they're like, we will ride upon your public infrastructure and pay no money to build it in the future. And so this is the problem of like putting up, you know, letting these like you said, a beauty contest or like this, you know, relying on Amazon to be this like fairy godmother of jobs where we could actually use public resources and tax Amazon and create the jobs ourselves, right? I mean, there's no reason Amazon should get a tax break, right? And there's no reason at all.
And one
go wherever
things,
you want.
Right, but like as you said though, any company who would have come there would have gotten a tax break.
And that's
like,
the problem.
Yeah. And if you believe that's fine. I guess I would just say that Amazon was going to bring in a lot more tax revenue than they were going to get. The city and the state were going to be better off. They were going to create, and they were only going to get the tax breaks if they actually created the jobs that they said that they were going to create. These were good jobs. And so
they were good jobs for like well-educated.
Yes, which are the kind of jobs we need in the city.
No, like, we don't need. We have plenty of those jobs in the city.
Actually,
we have a 3% unemployment rate. Yeah. If you are a well-educated computer engineer, it is not hard for you to find work in New York City.
Part of the problem, if you look at New York City moving forward, is that we currently have the financial industry, which is shrinking. We have media, which is not doing particularly well. We have maybe fashion, which is also not doing particularly well. New York City is looking to the future and saying, where is the growth coming? And you have a lot of people in the state and the city saying, we need to start investing in trying to get like new economy companies to come. Now, does this mean that no other company is ever going to come to New York? No, of course it doesn't. But I know this is not going to be a popular belief, but I think that this is not a good thing for New York. I think it shows that, frankly, New York needed Amazon more than Amazon needed New York.
I think that's, I disagree because the data doesn't back that up. And one is because I think you have, looking at who can afford to live and work in New York, it is not the $100,000 jobs. I mean, maybe Long Island City is a different thing, but you have New York and San Francisco that are super cities right now. They are getting, I mean, they are these hubs of everyone wants to go to New York or San Francisco, right, and a few other, Atlanta, maybe the greater Atlanta region. But you have all these other cities that are just devastated, dying, right, in spirals downwards, right? And so you have New York and San Francisco actually have created an ecosystem of jobs and equity and worth that, I think if New York City's worried, then the rest of us are
exactly
screwed.
And I think the way that you measure this is in property values. You know, like, in many ways, If you look at the difference, if you look at the value of land, like if you look at the difference between how much it costs to buy an apartment in New York versus how much it would cost to build that apartment, you know, that's the rents that are being extracted by the owners of the land. And the fact is that the land in New York is the most valuable land in America precisely because everyone wants to be here. Everyone wants to be able to, it's competing to pay a premium to live here because, as Richard Florida puts it, the world is spiky and New York is like the spikiest of the spikes. And, are you right, Anna, that like there is a possible world in the future where New York becomes less rich? You know, in a way we can but hope, you know, because because if America becomes a little bit more evenly distributed, that would probably be a good thing.
Yeah, I think one good thing this has done is sort of drawn attention to these subsidies that different cities and municipalities, you know, give out and sort of painted them in a bad light, because one thing that would be good is if everyone stopped doing this kind of thing. Like we saw what happened with Foxconn, right, in Wisconsin, where they promised it was a fiasco. And one benefit would be to stop kissing corporate ass all the time.
Exactly.
It's like, a race to the bottom. You can't have
cities and states competing with each other to see who can offer the greatest tax breaks to corporations, because that just results in corporations paying no taxes. As we just saw with Amazon, who for the second year running, you know, if you look at their 10-Ks, if you look at their annual reports, it looks as though they're basically not paying any taxes. Now, this is not the same as their tax filings. Their tax filings are confidential. We don't know what their corporate income taxes are. Yeah. But they're not high if they're even positive.
And it is right. I mean, the more jobs you get in a place, the more jobs are created. So you're right that, like, putting a net infusion of 25,000 or 50,000 jobs creates more jobs, right? So you have Amazon workers, but you need nail salons and yoga studios and all of that stuff. It's just that New York can't bear to pay those low service workers that much money. So there's this great book called The New Geography of Jobs, and they kind of map out, like, of Apple's, whatever, 10,000, 12,000 workers, they've created 60,000 other service sector jobs. But the question is, where do you house those people? Where do you house a nail salon person? And in San Francisco and New York, the poor, you know, and the nail salon workers are now being pushed further and further out into the city. And that's fine, right? So New York and San Francisco have these ecosystems of jobs creating more jobs. But then you have the rest of the country that I tend to worry about, too, is, like, you have these areas where no one is coming, right? So if Amazon wanted to do a public service, they could move to Detroit, you know, or to Baltimore, or to Ohio, where they could attract workers and create jobs there. They could revitalize in one fell swoop. Or we could do public programs, right? So I've suggested a few, like, you know, taking a city as an ecosystem and adding some infusions of, you know, Fed financing, whatever, to bring in a bunch of people and revitalize a city. You just need, it's like a complex network of a bunch of different things that go into it. You can't do it with one company, but you could do it with three different things and then wait and sort of benefit,
actually, it does happen. Like, my favorite example of this happening is Frisco, Texas.
Yeah.
And that was just a dusty bunch of farms. It's just north of Dallas. There was nothing there 20 years ago. It is now home to, like, 20 Fortune 500 headquarters. It is growing incredibly fast. They're building a new high school every 6 months. It's got an incredibly good school system. It's got an incredibly, like, high standard of living. Mm-hmm. Everyone loves it. It's possible to build these things ex nihilo, just literally out of nothing. What Amazon did when it announced its HQ2 beauty contest was basically saying, we are so big and our headquarters has the potential to be so big that we can change the facts on the ground and we can create a whole new area that does exactly what Mass is talking about and creates a whole bunch of ancillary jobs. And that's why a whole bunch of cities and states got excited about the idea. And then after looking at all of the proposals and getting bribed, you know, billions of dollars by various different municipalities, Amazon says, actually, you know what? We're just going to go to the rich places where we don't need to change the facts on the ground, because the facts on the ground are actually the best in America.
Exactly.
And that was just ridiculous.
And this is Seattle, too. I mean, Seattle, so Microsoft and Starbucks, before they got in there, Seattle was a crazy bad city, right? It was on this downward spiral. And, you know, Bill Gates wants to go back home, and he was in Albuquerque, moves up to Seattle. Then you have Starbucks, and now look at Seattle. I mean, Seattle overnight went from being a downward city into an upward one. So how do you do this? I mean, I have a plan right now with Roosevelt on, it's not out yet, but the Homestead Act, right? It's 21st Century Homestead Act. Don't laugh. I have proposed postal banking, too. I'm like one of these people that gets old things from the dustbin and puts them out. The Homestead Act is, you take Detroit, Baltimore, Ohio, whatever city is declining, there's a lot of abandoned homes in these areas. So 60% of the homes are abandoned. They're foreclosed on, usually owned by the city. Using Fed financing, and I have some complicated but really, like, not tax cuts, you buy up this land, you hand it over to residents with certain qualifications, so under 50,000 or whatever, give them the financing with, you know, whatever FHA sort of finance, low interest loan, and then have a public works program or two, right? So in Savannah, Georgia, we had a port. The state of Georgia created a public port, and it's one of the most profitable public ports. So some sort of public project, you're going to, you know, maybe do broadband, whatever, and to sort of revitalize it using public financing. I mean, that doesn't have to be what we do, but there are creative public ways, instead of waiting for Amazon and giving away essentially what we would use in public spending on tax credits, we could actually spend that and create the upward benefits. I mean, that was the heart of the New Deal, right? Mm-hmm. Public works projects that were the mixed economy.
Right, yeah, although the public works projects weren't actually what were the most successful parts of the New Deal. I mean, I think the most successful parts of the New Deal were the establishing of certain regulations and also establishing certain policies that later on, whereas, I mean, the New Deal was the actual, a lot of the programs did very little to spur development and employment. It wasn't until the war.
Not that the FHA, the GI Bill.
Oh, I agree. I mean, yeah, I agree. Yeah. That's why I said the things that later on did have a benefit. But I'm just saying, I think the history of extremely successful public works is mixed.
Yeah. Yes.
It's just so interesting.
You can do
that,
it wrong.
Like, we're willing, New York's willing to give Amazon $3 billion in tax breaks. But if we say, what about reparations?
Yeah.
People are like, that's we don't
crazy.
Give away money.
Yeah.
We don't
right.
do that.
We don't ask,
themselves.
Right? We only ask, how are you going to pay for it when it's like a social benefit? We don't ask, how are you going to pay for it when it's this massive tax cut? Or, I mean, not to mention military spending. We never ask, how are we going to pay for a war? You know, we ask, how are we going to pay for reparations? Mm-hmm. The same way we pay for the war.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
On which note, let's have a numbers round. Anna Szymanski, you can go first.
My number is 295 pounds.
Okay.
So this was the cost of the Brexit box for Brexit stockpiling made easier. It apparently has freeze-dried food that lasts 30 days, water filters, and a fire-starting gel.
Oh, my God.
So this is a real thing.
Stock up on canned goods and 295-pound Brexit boxes. What's that, like $350? Something like that?
Yes.
Yeah. Or it will be about $20 exactly. after Brexit goes horribly wrong. Mercer, do you bring a number?
Yes. 22. So it's not a funny number. Sorry. It's a sad one. White families have 22 times the wealth of black families.
Okay. My number is $1.2 million. That is the income of an unnamed investor who is in this great piece in the New York Times that just came out about how high income earner elite professionals are very, very unhappy. And the man who earns the $1.2 million says he's just so unhappy. He hates his life. He contemplated taking a job that paid half as much, and his wife laughed at him.
Only $600,000?
Only $600,000. His wife was like, we can't afford that. It's a nice little piece.
Yeah.
My number is 55, which is this little project that I just came out with on Axios. I've decided that we have talked too much about unicorns. And so now we need to talk about minotaurs. So unicorns are companies which are private VC-backed companies which are valued at $1 billion. Minotaurs are private VC-backed companies that have raised $1 billion in equity capital. So not like they would be worth $1 billion even if all they did was take the money that people had invested and they just put it in the bank in a checking account, paying 0%. We tallied this up. We found 55 minotaurs. These are companies which have raised over $1 billion, which, just to put that in perspective, when Eileen Lee, this venture capitalist, coined the term unicorns, there were 39 unicorns. So there are now more minotaurs today than there were unicorns just a few years ago.
And that was just like 10 years ago, yeah. She coined it?
So
just to bring it back around, a third of black families have zero to negative wealth. Wow. Just to
you mean they're not raising $1 billion by like, I mean, it's amazing.
Maybe the Minotaurs invest in opportunity zones and trickle down some of that money.
You should read the Gideon Lewis Krause piece in the New York Times magazine about WeWork and talking about how like they've raised, I think they're like $8.7 billion or something in equity capital that they've raised to invest in what is, according to Gideon, is basically a way of trying to hold at bay the existential angst of modernity or something
well,
like that.
I mean, the thing that makes me a little bit happy about the Minotaurs and the unicorns and the owners thereof are that they're building these bunkers of survivalist bunkers in New Zealand and these other places. They're terrified of the class revolution that they're, you know, and other just like basically the results of their, you know, greediness. They're actually, I don't think they sleep well at night. And so they have these bunkers, which makes me a little bit happy to think that it's not just pure, like, there's some existential fear in there of what they're doing.
I did get one response on Twitter from someone saying, oh, I know why you called it a Minotaur. It's because the Minotaur required an annual human sacrifice. Yeah.
Literally blood.
Exactly. Yeah. So on which sanguine note we will wrap up this edition of Slate Money. Thank you so much, Mercer, for coming all the way in from, where did you come in? We are in New York, because you're coming in all the way in from Midtown.
Thank you so much.
So yeah, many thanks to Mercer for coming in. Many thanks to Max Jacobs for producing. Many thanks to everyone out there for listening and for sending emails to slatemoney@slate.com. And we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.